Okay, let's get started. We left off in Zechariah chapter 10. That's where we're at tonight. If anyone needs a Bible, there's some right there on the table. Anyway, what I'd like to do is just quickly read through this chapter, and then we're going to go back and break it down as quickly as possible. Because, like I said, I think I need to close somewhat early tonight because of all the things that have been happening. Just keep in mind, if we're reading the book of Zechariah, Zechariah does cover an awful lot of ground as far as the first and second coming of Christ, as far as Christ's return, as far as the conditions of the world, as far as God's judgments on the nations, as far as him setting up his millennial kingdom. And it always amazes me that when you read these prophets, especially someone like Zechariah that lived over 500 years before Christ, how far-reaching his prophecies are and how we have seen the fulfillment of a lot of it he predicted in Jesus' first coming. And now we could take it literally in terms of all things that are going to unfold as Christ's second coming, you know, occurred. Okay, it's only 12 verses. It does cover an awful lot of ground, especially if you take it in the historical context of the time that Zechariah made this prophecy. Remember, he made this prophecy when just a small remnant of the Jews had come back from captivity after being in exile in Babylon for over 70 years. And now there's just a small remnant of people struggling, you know, to rebuild themselves as a nation. And everything looked pretty bleak and pretty hopeless because they were so overwhelmed in terms of the nations around them, as far as, you know, they had absolutely no military to speak of. They had, you know, in comparison to all of these different mighty nations, I mean, Israel was reduced to zero. And so their future looked pretty bleak. But Zechariah is making some pretty far-reaching prophecies here, and they extend right into the millennial period and predict the second coming of Christ and what's going to happen to the Jews as a people at that particular time. And there's one thing that if you look at the Jewish nation, the Jew in and of himself is a modern-day miracle. Israel is a modern-day miracle in terms of its mere existence. By all the laws of men and nations, Israel should not even be around today. They should have been wiped off the face of the earth thousands of years ago. There's no question about it. If you just look at their history, there's no other explanation except by divine intervention that they are even in existence. Okay, and at this particular time that Zechariah made this prophecy about the Jews, they really didn't have much of a future to look forward to. Even though they were back in their land, they had lost so much of what they once had because of their rebellion, because of their disobedience, because of their idolatry, and they forgot God, they forsaken him. And so he just gave them over to their enemies and they were destroyed. But he saved himself a remnant, and he's going to rebuild, and now he's prophesying through Zechariah some very promising, a very promising future for them. But go back to that first verse. What Zechariah says is, this is the Lord speaking. He says, ask rain from the Lord at the time of the spring rain, and the Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them to give them showers of rain, vegetation in the field to each man. For the teraphim speaks iniquity, and the diviners see lying visions, and tell false dreams, and they comfort in vain. Therefore the people wander like sheep, and they are afflicted because there is no shepherd. Okay, this to me is very applicable to today. There's no question about it. If you look at the fact that, look around us, okay, and take a look at just where people are looking for answers to. I mean, isn't it phenomenal? I mean, I got the Time magazine in there. I don't know. I haven't even read it. I haven't even opened it. But on the front cover of Time magazine, they got Brad Pitt, and they said about his new movie that's out called 7 Years in Tibet. And on the front cover, they're talking about how, you know, this movie is showing how so many people are getting into Buddhism and Zen and into this Eastern mysticism today. Okay, so many people are looking in so many different places for answers. It's just astounding when you look around you and see how many people put their faith and trust solely in God. No, they look at all these other different things. All you have to do is go to any grocery store, pick up any of these tabloids, any one of them. I challenge you, next time you're in there, pick up a tabloid, any one of them, and you go through, just thumb through while you're standing in line, count the number, just the number of advertisements that you will see in any of these magazines for astrology, for psychics, okay, for healers, for all of the different things that are in these magazines. That's just one stretch of them, right? Okay? I mean, I took Gail and the kids out to dinner, I think it was last week, like before we went over this Chinese restaurant up here, and we were sitting down, and it's a Chinese restaurant, and they got these placemats underneath this plastic partition, and you they've got, well, it's a Chinese zodiac, okay? Well, you've got the bull and the cow and all these different things, okay, right? And, you know, my kids are asking me about these things. And I said, and so they want to know, okay, what year are you born? I said, okay, I'll tell you what you guys do. I'm going to show you how foolish this stuff is. You tell me what year you're born, and you read out what you are. Okay, and they got the pig and the goat. Well, you know what I'm talking about? Okay, and then they tell you these things. Okay, but what I did with my kids is, okay, now you read what that says. Now, what year was I born? Okay, so I had them read each one of ours. Now I said, now, let's just change it all around. Let's say that you were born this year instead of that year. Now let's see, read what it says. And so everything that's said there can be applied. See what I'm saying? But there was a real, I think, subtle form of occultic deception in it, in the fact that in so many of the overviews of what they would say, it's not good for you to marry such and such a person who was born in such and such a year, okay, because you're not compatible. Now, you see, everything they said in each one of these zodiac signs, you could apply to anyone, right? But the subtlety of it was they said, you do not match well with a person born in this particular year, so stay away from the bull or the cow or the dragon or whoever, right? So I said, see, kids, this is what the devil does, okay? You can read each one of these, what they're kind of like horoscopes, and they really tell you nothing. They say everything and say nothing at the same time, you see? So everybody's flattered. They say, oh, well, you know, that applies to me. But if you read every one of them, you say, oh, that applies to me. To some degree, some way, some shape, some form, okay? They covered every base. But the big deception is when they suggest to you, don't get involved with somebody born here. So then, instead of looking to God, right, for wisdom, guidance, and direction as far as a marriage partner, they say, well, this says I better not do it, right? So they're hooked. Hook, line, and sinker. The devil's got them by the throat. Instead of going to God and seeking, Lord, you know, give me a spouse, a helpmate in my life that will be compatible to your will, that I can that I could share you and my life with, that can have a common denominator in which to build a godly marriage and godly children and so on and so forth, guide me and direct me. No, they're looking at this stupid thing, right? Instead of to God. You see this, where this country's at? Millions of people in this country will not get out of bed in the morning without reading a horoscope. And the horoscopes are a joke. If you've got any spiritual insight at all, you can read each horoscope and you see that every one of them you can apply somehow. It's everything's so vague, everything's so general, but there's always a subtle catch to it, okay? Always a subtle catch. There might be something like, well, today's your lucky day. So then if you say, well, when you go up to Reno and you happen to win $50, what are you going to do the next morning? You're going to go back to a horoscope because it said something there. Okay, but it's always very vague. It's saying, hey, today you need to be very careful. Well, that's pretty vague, isn't it? So they're extra careful, nothing happens. They say, ooh, wow, glad that I got through today. Isn't that asinine? Who are they looking to guide their life? Are they looking to God for wisdom, guidance, and direction? Are they looking to the stars and the planets, who know nothing? Absolutely nothing. A man can comprehend a star. A star knows nothing, but they're letting these stars rule their eyes. Well, there's a spiritual dimension behind it, a force behind it that is getting people away from God. That's why when we read here, to me, it's so simple, yet so profound, because so many people are always looking, what's that name of that song, looking for love in all the wrong places. I mean, they're looking for answers in all the wrong places. They're not looking to Jesus Christ for wisdom, guidance, and direction in their life. Okay? They're not seeking God's counsel. They're looking everywhere, under every nook and cranny, for an answer, but they're not looking to God. Well, that's the way his people got. That's the way this nation is. We have forgotten God. And it's just astounding. It's amazing and it's scary to see the number of things that people will look to for answers. Right? Read this again. Ask rain from the Lord. You know, not some phony tabloid advertising some psychic's prediction. Okay, ask rain from the Lord at the time of the spring rain. Okay, you know, there was a ladder in the spring rains. The spring rains were very necessary because they softened up the ground. They prepared for planting, and then there was ladder rains. I mean, these things come from God. God has control of all these things. And I think it's very significant that if you, in the latest U.S. News World Report, on the front cover, there's they're talking about this El Nino. Okay, and it's all over the papers and everything, and they're saying, well, they're predicting one of the worst winters on record that's going to happen to us. Okay, well, you know, I'll wait and see, but I believe that, yeah, if it's going to happen, it's God giving us another warning, saying, okay, you know, you guys are not listening, nobody's repenting, you're not turning away from your sins, you continue to act worse and worse, so here, we see what's coming. Well, who's behind this? They talk about El Nino as though it's just some kind of fluke of nature. How many people say God's hand behind this and they're saying, hey, I'm warning you, I'm warning you? No, how many people see that? Not too many. Not too many people. Yeah, you know, it's like they're totally oblivious to it. They just feel like, well, Mother Nature might be on a rampage. You know, rather than saying, hey, God's going to try to shake people up. But let's face it, okay, how many people really take God seriously? Okay, as long as their lives are halfway satisfactory to themselves. I mean, I've heard dozens and dozens and dozens and probably hundreds of different testimonies over the years. And I can only think of one off the top of my head where the person says that he came to the Lord and he wasn't in desperation. I mean, that's a sad commentary on human nature, isn't it? Hey, I mean, I'm like it, everybody else like it. In other words, as long as our lives are halfway comfortable and satisfactory to ourselves, do we really seek God with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength? You know, what does God have to do? He has to light a fire under our rear ends before we finally go, oh, well, you know, I need help. So, you see this El Nino coming down the pike, you know, there's going to be a lot of destruction. There's going to be a lot of, maybe even loss of life. It's going to be God trying to shake people up. But how many people are going to listen? If let's say, history is any indicator, well, there's not going to be a whole lot. Okay, but God loves us too much to allow us to continue to sit in our complacency. Because people are continuing to look everywhere and anywhere but to God. It seems like the only time that you're going to take God serious, you know, is if their hiney's being singed with some kind of problems. I don't know whether it be financial or marital or, you know, material or physical or whatever, right? I mean, that's a sad commentary on human nature, isn't it? But the thing is, it says something about God, too. God's not proud. He'll stoop to conquer. He'll take us, even though we have demonstrated time and time again that we prefer everything and anything but him. We're only going to want him when it's the last resort. You know, how many times does that happen to God? But he's not proud. He'll save us, you know. Yeah, right? He'll bend, he'll stoop down and pick us up, okay? But he's not going to do it unless we give him undivided attention. And that's why it says here, ask from the Lord, you know. Don't ask the psychics and these phonies, you know, for the answers to our lives. Ask the Lord at the time of spring rain, the Lord the maker, the Lord who makes the storm clouds. He's the one that's behind this El Nino, I guarantee you. It's not Mother Nature. It's not some impersonal cosmic force. It says, and he will give them showers of rain and vegetation in the fields to each man. For the teraphim speaks iniquity. What's a teraphim?
Household idols.
It's a household idol. You read in the Old Testament, Laban's daughter, Rachel, Jacob's wife, had a teraphim, and it was small enough where she sat on it to hide it from, her father-in-law. And then there was a mention of teraphim in the Book of Samuel, where one of David's wives, Michal, lowered David out the window to escape the wrath of her father, and she put a teraphim, which apparently was as big as a man, in the bed and covered it over like it was David's sleep. Okay, so what I'm saying is these household idols could be very, very small or the size of a man, but it was like they would look to these different things for what? Okay, for guidance, for direction, for answers. They were like, maybe some of them would use like good luck charms, or they would keep away evil spirits. I mean, there was all kinds of different sizes and shapes and forms, but they were household idols. Okay? And I've said this 1,000 times. The biggest household idol of the 20th century is this thing, this boob tube, this idiot box, the TV. Okay? How many people are sitting right in front of this thing right now, being mesmerized, they're turning their brain into chewing gum, where, what is it doing? Is it improving their lives at all? Okay, is it enriching it in the least bit? No, people are being fed all of this pig manure, okay, that's really taking them away from God, driving them away, giving them a whole different value system, indoctrinating them with what? The things of the world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, all of these things. There's nothing wrong with owning a TV, but the problem is the TV, almost 80%, 90% of the time, owns the people. They have no control over it. I mean, the average person who speaks watches 56 hours a week of TV. I mean, that's astounding. But, you know, what does it say to us as a nation? So, what I'm saying, what it says here, from the teraphim speak iniquity. Okay, you could just, for our purposes, from the TV it speaks iniquity, doesn't it? And the diviners seek lying visions. The diviner is a person who is a fortune teller. Okay, there was all kinds of diviners, and there's all kinds of diviners today, but there's all kinds of them back then. A diviner was something, they would use all kinds of means to try to tell the future. They would cut open animals and spread out their entrails, and however they fell, they would say, well, because the liver's over here and the gut's over here, this is that, they would try to predict the future. Okay? They used to do it with arrows. They still do this type of stuff today. They will take bones and shake them around like they're dice and throw them out a certain way. If they follow a certain pattern, they'll say this, you know, they try to predict the particular future there. Well, we got diviners today. They're all over the place. Not just the astrologers. People who have tarot cards will try to predict your future. Well, this is all demonically inspired. Believe me, the devil is behind it all. People say, well, this is just for fun. But believe me, the devil is not laughing. Okay, in a sense that he's very serious. He is out to deceive people. And he doesn't care what you believe in. I mean, isn't it asinine? You know, he has people throw out the guts and the entrails of an animal and say, well, hey, this will predict your future, rather than looking at God's word. Isn't that making a mockery of what God intended us to do? How asinine can we get? And yet this is what people do day in and day out. Okay? And that's why he's saying that, what he's saying here, the diviners see lying visions. Okay? They'll look at the entrails of a cat or whatever, a dog or a cow or a goat, a pig, and they're going to tell the future by that? Hey, I wouldn't recommend this, but I guarantee you, if you call, you now they got on TV, they got all these commercials that come on as far as these psychic hotlines. They say, hey, dial this 800 number and we will give you a free consultation or even a free example of our power. Okay? But they won't tell you anything. They won't tell you at all. First of all, they'll try, not that I've done this, but I know how they work. You know, you can't end on and say, hey, I want to see if you're really a psychic. Can you tell me my name? They're going to say, duh, no. You know, they want you to, well, tell me what your name is. Tell me where you're born. Are you married? Are you this? And then they get all these little bits of information. And then they give you a general baloney where you say, oh, yeah, well, that's true. You understand what I'm saying? These aren't psychics. These are phonies. But they don't look to God. See, this whole thing is just, it's orchestrated by the devil and his demonic beings who are trying to get men to look everywhere and any place but to God for the answers. Don't look good. Don't look to the Bible. Look at your horoscope. That's what, you know, I mean, this is making a mockery of what God intended us to do as far as seeking Him and seeking His face and seeking His will and seeking for guidance and direction to be dependent upon Him and to cling to Him. No, you know, devil's doing everything to pry people away from God, and people are being led around like pigs to a slaughter. You know, there's no question about it. Because what it says here, it says, for the terrapins speak iniquity, and the diviners seek lying visions and tell false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore, the people wander like sheep. Isn't that what this country is doing today? We got people wandering all over like sheep lost. Right? And everybody's following all these phony pipe pipers, right? That claim to have the answers, and nobody's looking to God for the word. When I say nobody, you know what I mean. I mean, the overwhelming majority of people are completely ignoring, you know, the truth. Because they don't want to hear the truth. Because they know deep down in their gut, the truth requires a commitment. And it's that simple. And that's why we are told in the book of Thessalonians that in the last days, you know, it says very plainly that God is going to allow people a strong deception. Because they would not believe the love of the truth so as to be saved. In other words, they don't love the truth. It's not what they want to hear. So they don't love it. So they say, okay, you don't want to hear the truth? All right, you're going to be told some of the biggest whoppers, and you're going to fall for it hook, line, and sinker, and it ain't going to be my fault. Well, the devil says he's got all these whoppers out now. Imagine what's going to happen when he does come with great signs and great power, great wonder under the power of the Antichrist. There's going to be a lot of big fish then. It says here, they are afflicted because there is no shepherd. In other words, no true spiritual leader. This is what happened to Israel during, Zechariah's time and during a time prior before their exile. Okay, it's happening to this nation. You know, you know, we're afflicted because there is no shepherd. Now, the shepherd is a leader. Look at our political leadership today. It is a circus. It is a zoo. It is a joke. We don't have anybody that really has any gumption to stand up for what is right, stand up for what is true, what is honest, what is honorable, what is, you know, to do the right thing. Find yourself somebody who stands up for righteousness. He's labeled a fanatic, an extremist, you know, a threat to everybody and everything, right? So they're all compromised. And then you get up there and you get these people like we got now. Every time I look at these guys, I just feel like, man, we are just getting what we deserve, you know, as a people, as a nation, because this is what we want. But you see, this is only a foreshadow of what's coming. The world's going to get what it's been asking for a long time. And it's going to get it in the Antichrist, and it's going to be, you know, like what did Jesus say? He said of his own people, his own generation, I have come in my Father's name, and you rejected me, but another will come in his own name, and you will accept him. Well, this one we see his shadow right now. He's just right, waiting in the wings right now. And it says here in verse 3, it says, my anger is kindled against the shepherds or the leaders, spiritual and political. And that's this nation too. And I will punish the male goats. For the Lord of hosts will visit his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his majestic horse in battle. So what he's saying here, this is a prophecy that he's making. He's saying that his anger is kindled against the leadership. And he said he will punish the male goats. Well, what are the male goats? Well, it's just a symbolism that's used for those who are in a position of power or authority. But remember how Jesus used it in Matthew 25. He said in the last days he will come back and he will separate the sheep and the goats. Okay, on what basis? He says, those on my right, he said, hey, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was in prison, and you did all these things for me. Those on the left are the goats. He says, I was sick, I was hungry, naked, in prison, a stranger, and so on. You did nothing for me, right? So he separates the sheep and the goats on that basis. The true leaders are those who serve the people. Okay? Spiritual needs of the people and everything else. The goats represent those who only serve themselves. Well, this is what we have for leadership today. Isn't that true? Do you see people in leadership serving, okay, the people acting as servants? Do you see this? No. No. They can't push any through anything, okay, for the good of this country. But give them a chance to give themselves a raise, wham. There's no bickering, no bipartisans, and it's just, hey, you know, this is done. And it's done in the middle of the night, and it's just overdone and through, and we got ourselves a $3,000, $4,000 raise. Right? But they can't do anything else. You look at these hearings that are going on now, it's like everything is stonewalled, everything's filibustered, everything is, oh, I can't remember, I can't recall, or, you know, the lost the documents, they shredded them, everything's just a joke, right? But they can do what they want to do. Why? Because they're serving themselves. They are goats. Well, this is the kind of leadership that we got. And unfortunately, this is true in a lot of churches today, where you have goats as leaders, not shepherds. When I say goats as leaders, they say, hey, they're milking their flock, they're fleecing them. For money, for material things, for whatever. I mean, they're not exalting Christ. They're not out there binding up the wounds of the spiritually and emotionally and physically. No. Hey, they're out there fleecing them. They're out there saying, giving this baloney about health, wealth, and prosperity. You just send in money and you'll be blessed. And all. That's all baloney. But they're goats. It says here, my anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the male goats, for the Lord of hosts who has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and I will make them like his majestic horse in battle. So here is a prophecy about Christ's second coming. When Christ comes back, he's going to take the bull by the horns. It says here, the Lord of hosts has visited his flock. He will come down, okay, and it's, you know, this Christ when he returns, and the house of Judah. Okay, now Christ visited his flock to the house of Judah, his first coming as a babe, okay, as an unknown infant in Bethlehem. But he came through the tribe of Judah. And Christ is referred to as the Lion of Judah. He came first as a babe. And now he's going to, in his second coming, will be as a lion through the house of Judah. Okay, because we were told way back in the book of Genesis that a scepter will not depart from Judah. Scepter is the ruling authority. Okay, that through the tribe of Judah would come the leader of all mankind. Of course, Christ was born in the tribe of Judah, okay, a descendant of David. So he says here that he will make them, and he's talking about them, he's talking about the tribe of Judah, his majestic horse in battle. In other words, he's going to use the tribe of Judah as he comes through this tribe, comes and becomes a man through this particular tribe. They're going to be used, in a sense, as an instrument of warfare to judge the ungodly and the wicked. And then he says in verse 4, from them will come the cornerstone, from them the tent peg, from them the bow of battle, from them every ruler of all men together. Now, it's using the word them, but it's got a footnote, and some of the Bibles may say him. Anybody in the Bible say him? Okay, him or them, it really applies to the same person. Who is it? No. We just read about who it was. Who is it? Through Judah. Judah. Okay, read that again in verse 4. From them, the tribe of Judah, or from him, Judah. Okay? From the tribe of Judah will come the cornerstone. The cornerstone is who? Christ. We are told that again and again and again in Scripture, that he is the chief cornerstone. So from Judah, or from the tribe of Judah, comes the chief cornerstone, which is Christ. From them, or Judah, the tent peg. Now the tent peg, you read in the book of Isaiah, chapter 22, you read that, you know, there's a prophecy about Christ that he will be a peg in which everything hangs. Okay, what are you hanging your hope on? What are you hanging it on? Are you hanging it on science? Are you hanging on our new technology, on the internet, on your education, you know, on your money, on your piggy bank? What are you hanging your hopes on? If it is not on Jesus Christ, believe me, it's not going to hang there much longer. If we hang our hopes and our dreams and our goals and everything on Christ, we are on solid ground. That's why he's referred to as a tent peg, okay, in which we hang everything on. Okay, that's what it means here. From them, the tent peg, or from Judah, or from the tribe of Judah, the tent peg. From them, or Judah, the bow of battle. In other words, it's God is going to, you know, through the tribe of Judah, Christ is going to come, and he's going to be used as a bow of battle, in other words, to judge the wicked, to deal with the wicked, okay, to punish the wicked. And from them, every ruler of them together. Okay, it's in other words, there coming a time when Christ will set up his millennial kingdom, and he will rule and reign with who? His saints. Okay, and he makes it very clear in the book of Revelation that he's going to rule as with a rod of iron. Okay, and it makes reference to the fact that just as iron will smash clay. In other words, when Christ comes back to rule and reign, there's going to be perfect harmony and perfect peace, and there's going to be social and economic justice. There's going to be not going to be this racism and this all this diversity that causes so much division and hatred and prejudice and contempt and all of this, disproportionate wealth distribution in terms of people living in abject poverty and grinding misery and other people living with billions and billions of dollars they don't know what to do with. You see what I'm saying? When Christ comes back, there's going to be a social and economic prosperity, you know, that's going to rule and reign throughout the globe. Okay, but he's going to rule and reign the world with his saints. Okay, but when Christ is ruling and reigning, we're not going to have a democracy. It's not going to be this kind of democracy that we see today. Our democracy, okay, is the best thing going. Okay, as far as the world is concerned, but look at how we are becoming deadlocked now. Our diversity is our undoing. We've now come to the point where we really are in a situation where we locked horns in basically the liberals against the conservatives. Okay, they have their agenda, we have our agenda, whatever, how else you want to look at it, and it's just nothing is working. Well, when Christ comes back, it's not going to be a democracy. It's going to be a theocracy in the sense that, hey, he's the leader. What he says goes. He's the king. He's the emperor. You know, you don't like it, off goes your head. It's that simple. I mean, then you're going to see truth, rule, and reign, and there'd be peace and economic justice. And if somebody goes out there and kills somebody, hey, there's going to be immediate divine retribution. You know, you're not going to see this O.J. baloney. You're not going to see these flim-flam and flamboyant, worthless, good-for-nothing lawyers running around, okay, making a complete mockery of truth and justice and honesty and integrity. You're not going to see this. You know, it's a day, it's going to be a glorious day for some. It's going to be curtains for other people. He says here in verse 5, he says, and they will be as mighty men. They, of course, will be those who he rules with, his people, ruling with him, ruling and reigning with him. They will be as mighty men, treading down the enemy in the mire of the streets of battle. They will fight for the Lord and be with them, and the riders of horses will be put to shame. Okay, when he's talking about them, he's talking about, okay, the reference is to Judah, but he's talking about his tribe, his people. And when Christ comes back, he's coming back on a white horse. And he's coming back, who's going to be with him? The armies of heaven. Okay? Multitudes and multitudes, thousands, millions coming back with him on white horses. Saints, angels, they need to reclaim this planet when it's on the very brink of total, utter destruction and annihilation. And he's going to set things right and recreate everything that's completely ruined. The world's going to be a total ecological disaster. The sun is going to be had nova and burned out. It'll become as black as sackcloth. The moon will be blood red. You know, the oceans will be turned to blood. Every tree, every blade of grass will be burned up. I mean, you talk about an ecological total disaster. I mean, that's what's going to do. This world's going to be reduced to a burned out cinder. And Jesus Christ predicted that. He said, if I don't cut these days short, nobody's going to survive. No flesh will be saved. That's how disastrous it's going to be. Okay. But when he comes back with the armies of heaven, he's going to set things right. And he says, treading down the enemy in the mire of the streets in battle, and they will fight for the Lord, and they will be with them, and the riders of horses will be put to shame. In other words, the enemies that come against Christ. Remember, because in that last closing hours of history, there's going to be that final battle of Armageddon, where you've got 200 million men from the east fighting hundreds of millions of men from the west. And they see Christ coming with great power, great glory, and we are told in the book of Revelation that they make war upon the Lamb. In other words, they turn their guns on Christ. And Christ just speaks the word, expunges every last drop of blood that's coursing through their veins out of them. John says it forms a river as high as a horse's bridle, which is almost 5 feet high, for 200 miles, which is the entire length of Israel. So you talk about unbelievable carnage is coming. I mean, God is long-suffering. He's patient. He's merciful. He's forgiving. But, hey, we get to the point where we've crossed that line of no return, and there's nothing left but wrath. He says in verse 6, he says, and I shall strengthen the house of Judah, and I shall save the house of Joseph. When he talks about strengthening the house of Judah, remember how the tribes were divided into the north and the south? The tribe of Joseph, there was no tribe of Joseph. Or there was a house of Joseph, okay? But remember, Joseph, basically, because of his obedience to God, and God used him in a mighty way to save his people way back in the time when he became prime minister of Egypt, Joseph had two sons. One of them was named Manasseh, one of them was Ephraim. Okay, so Joseph got a double portion through his sons of the land of Israel. So when we talk about the tribe of Joseph, we're talking about northern Israel. Okay, and the tribe of Judah was southern Israel. But what it says here is, I shall strengthen the house of Judah, and I shall save the house of Joseph. In other words, all of Israel is going to be saved at that particular time. And it says, and I shall bring them back. Okay, well, we've seen the return of the Jews beginning way back in 1917 under the Balfour Treaty, where they recognized Palestine as being a national homeland for the Jews. And then in 1948, they became a nation again. Okay? And now they are what Zechariah predicts further on in his prophecy. They have become a burdensome stone to the whole world. They can't move it. Well, you see that they're a modern-day miracle. And he says, I shall bring them back. They began in 1948, or back to 1917, really.
Says Ephraim, the 10 tribes. I thought it was 12 tribes.
It's 12 tribes, okay? Because Jacob had 12 sons, all right? But keep a couple things in mind. The way they divided the land, Levi never got a portion of land. Levi was the priestly tribe. So rather than getting a portion of land and being included in the 12 tribes, he was rather given the priestly role of being distributed among the cities of all the tribes, to act as the priest, okay, for all these different tribes. In terms of Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Israel. But you don't find a tribe of Joseph. What you find is the tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim. These were two of Joseph's sons. They were his two sons who ended up, Joseph basically got what they called the major inheritance. He got a double portion because of his loyalty and commitment to God. All right? So there's still 12 tribes, all right? Matter of fact, you go back to the book of Revelation, and when John talks about there being 144,000, remember? Now, they're not Jehovah's Witnesses, and they're not Mormon elders. He talks about 144,000. He lists 12,000 from each tribe, and what's interesting, he doesn't mention the tribe of Ephraim. He doesn't mention the tribe of Manasseh. He mentions the tribe of Joseph. Okay? So it's like, it's coming right full circle now. At the end of the world, there's going to be, nobody in Israel, I think, knows today exactly what tribe they belong to, but God knows. So when he says there are going to be 148,000 Jews, believe me, he knows there are going to be 12,000 from each tribe.
144,000.
Yeah, what am I saying? What am I?
148.
I'm sorry. I got that in my mind for some reason. It's 144,000. Thanks for correcting me on that. Okay, but it's 12,000 from each tribe. All right, let's wind it down. He says in verse, he says, "And I shall bring them back because I have compassion on them, and they will be as though I had not rejected them. For I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them." Well, interesting thing here. He says he's going to bring them back. Well, remember when Isaiah wrote this, they had already gone through one dispersion. They went through, the northern tribes were dispersed by the Assyrians, and then the tribe of Judah was dispersed by the Babylonians. But since then, when Zechariah wrote this, there was a remnant that came back from Babylon, but here it's talking about how he's going to bring them back again. So in other words, it's almost an implication that they were going to be scattered once more, which they were. In 70 AD, under the Roman commander Titus, all of Israel was ended up being scattered through every nation on earth. And now they're coming back. We see a beginning of this fulfillment, but when Christ rules and reigns in Jerusalem, they'll all be back there. Okay. In verse 7, it says, "And Ephraim," okay, now Ephraim, like I said, it was the son of Joseph, but it stands for the northern 10 tribes. Okay. He says, "And Ephraim will be like a mighty man, and their heart will be glad as if from wine. Indeed, their children will see it and be glad." In other words, Israel. When we talk about Ephraim, just substitute the word Israel. Well, Israel is in dire straits today. Okay, she's in existence, but let's face it, she's surrounded by enemies, right? And she's plagued by violence, by terrorism, okay, by threats from in and out, okay? So you don't see them, you don't see this fulfilled today, do you? Read it again. In verse 7, "And Ephraim will be like a mighty," or "Israel will be like a mighty man, and their heart will be glad as if from wine. Indeed, the children will see it and be glad. They will, their heart will rejoice in the Lord." Well, you see, their heart isn't with Christ because they've rejected Christ as their Messiah as a whole. Okay, there are individual Jews that have accepted him. Okay, but as a whole, the nation has rejected him. Well, when he does come back, they're going to see him. And it says, Zechariah says that they will mourn over him. They will see him whom they have pierced, whom they crucified, and they will mourn over him. They will weep over him as though it was their only son that they lost. They will be grieved. They will be overwhelmed with a sense of shame and guilt for the rejection of their Messiah. Okay, but then things are going to be set right between them and God. And then it's going to be a time when what? Their heart will rejoice in the Lord, it'll be a time when their children will see it and be glad. Verse 8 says, "I will whistle to them to gather them together, for I have redeemed them." Okay, well, we're seeing this now. There's an enormous influx of Jews from all over the world today into Israel. They're coming in by the hundreds, by the thousands, every single month to Israel from all over the world. They kind of, and you know, amazing thing is you see the black Jews coming in there today? I mean, you wouldn't think there'd be black Jews, but there was Jews who was dispersed in Africa, and over 100 centuries and centuries and centuries of living in Africa, they're black, but they're Jews, and they're coming back, and they're coming back from every corner of the globe, speaking every different language and everything, because they were under God's judgment. So that's an amazing prophecy to me. We see for being fulfilled before our very eyes, but it's going to have its ultimate fulfillment when Christ comes back, sets us in the millennial kingdom. Then they're all going to go back there. We got, I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's more Jews in New York City than there is in Israel today. Okay? But you're not going to see that when Christ is ruling and reigning. They're all going to be back there then. You know? Why would they want to be in New York and be back here? You know? He says, "I will whistle for them to gather them together. I have redeemed them. They will be as numerous as they were before." Well, remember now, they're just a remnant when Zechariah wrote this. Okay? Numerous as they were before. Well, during the zenith of their glory, their power was in Solomon's reign, David's reign. Okay, they numbered in the millions. Well, now there's only a few thousand, okay, that have come back as a remnant during Zechariah's day, and they are surrounded by enemies, and they don't look like they've got much of a future, but God says, "I'm going to make them as numerous as they once were." When they came out of Israel, when they came out of Egypt, they were, you know, estimated there was 3 million of them, because they said they had 600,000 men who could carry the sword. In other words, they were just the men alone. I mean, just that age group, I think it was around between 18 and 55 or something, where they could carry a sword. In other words, they were military age. So if you figure there were 600,000 military age men coming out of Egypt, there was probably around 3 million that crossed the Red Sea. Okay? Then he says here in that verse 9, he says, "When I scatter them among the peoples, they will remember me in far countries. And they, their children, will live and come back." Okay, well, this is what happens. Okay, they start to remember God in their far countries. Okay, and most of them have not accepted Christ. But okay, a lot of them are turning back to their roots as far as Judaism. And that's kind of preparing their hearts in a way okay, for when the Messiah does come back, to accept him. See what I'm saying? So he says in that verse 10, it says, I will bring them back from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon until no room can be found for them. Okay, when he's talking about bringing them back from Egypt and Assyria, that stands for, okay, the Egypt stands for the world, okay, in a spiritual sense. Assyria stands for those who are opposed to God's people, all right? Because remember, the Assyrians had overrun the northern tribes of Israel back in 722 BC. Okay, and it wasn't until over 100 years later that the southern tribe went into captivity, but they went in under the Babylonians. So the Assyrians were no longer a superpower at this particular time. Neither were the Egyptians. But so I think what he's basically saying is that they stand for all the powers, all the countries where God had scattered his people and punished them through these foreign powers. He's going to gather them back from these nations. Okay? He says, I will bring them back to the land of Gilead and Lebanon. Well, Gilead and Lebanon, he's basically saying that they will fill the nation, the country, from top to bottom, from north to south. Okay? And he says, basically said that the land will be once again overflowing with Jews. Okay? What we see today is just a constant battle going on between the Palestinians and the Jews, right? You know, Jews want to build a homeland or put up a trailer or a tent or anything, man. They just, you know, they got to fight for every little inch, okay, and then defend it with every last drop of blood that they've got, because they're surrounded by so many people who can't, they hate them, they want them destroyed. Well, when Christ comes back, this is their possession that God had promised them through Abraham, and they're going to possess it. He says, no room to be found. Verse 11 says, and he will pass through the sea of distress and strike the waves in the sea, so that all the depths of the Nile will dry up, and the people of Assyria will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt will depart, and I shall strengthen them in the Lord, and in his name they will walk, declares the Lord. So again, this is a prophecy, a far-reaching prophecy that was written over 500 years before Christ was born, but it has to deal with the millennial reign of Christ. Okay? What Zechariah was predicting has yet to come to pass, but we are on the very threshold of its fulfillment as far as history is concerned. Okay, I personally believe we will see its fulfillment. We are that close to it. So if you read this at verse 11 again, the closing verse of this chapter 10, it says, and he will pass through the sea of distress and strike the waves in the sea. In other words, you know, that God is going to be with them in this conflict, okay, and then he's going to strike down their enemies. Okay, when it talks about strike down the waves of the sea. Okay, in other words, what happened with Peter when he began to walk on water? He was flying until when? He took his eyes off Christ and put his eyes on the waves. The waves represent, you know, okay, in a sense, our troubles and our problems and our enemies and everything else, right? Well, when they put their eyes on Christ, you know, then they will pass through the sea, pass through the water. The same thing with us. When we get our eyes off Christ, regardless of what our problems are, you know, we begin to go down fast, don't we? And like Peter said, we say, Lord, help us. Well, and this is, you know, kind of speaking in symbolic or figurative language here, but I think it's very, very applicable, because he says, and he will pass through the sea of distress and strike the waves in the sea, so that the depths of the Nile will dry up, and the pride of Assyria will be brought down. In other words, this is when he comes back. Okay, he's going to deal with their enemies, and all of their problems and difficulties are going to be put behind him. And he says, and the scepter of Egypt will depart. Now, the scepter stands for what? A scepter is nothing more than a rod. It was usually made of gold and had a kind of crown on the end of it, a type. That is simply, it was a king, the emperor, holds the scepter. This symbolized the power. When he's going to take away the scepter from Egypt, Egypt represents what? The world. Okay? So, in other words, The world is no longer going to be ruled and reigned, okay, by all of these different governments or leaders or dictators or despots. It's going to be ruled and reigned by Christ. Okay, that's where the scepter is going to rest, finally. And there'll be peace and prosperity throughout the world and happiness and joy. And, you know, this is what is going to transpire once he comes back and reclaims this world. And in verse 12 it says, and I shall strengthen them in the Lord, and in his name they will walk, declares the Lord. This is kind of significant, because if there's not a Trinity, this really isn't very good grammar, is it? Because it's not, you know, the way he says, I will strengthen them in the Lord. Well, he is the Lord. right? So, in other words, again, you go back to Psalm 110, it says, the Lord said to my Lord. So, when we're talking about Lord here, it's a distinct person, different persons in the Trinity. He says, I shall strengthen them in the Lord, and in his name they will walk, declares the Lord. Well, obviously the Jew is not walking in Christ's name today. Right? As a nation, they've rejected him, right? But he will strengthen them in the Lord. In other words, he'll come back, great power, great glory. They will recognize him as being the Messiah that they rejected, that they crucified. They will mourn over him as a lost and only son. And at that time, you know, then they will begin to walk in the statues and recognize Christ as being their Savior, their Messiah, okay, their anointed one, the promised prophet that Moses predicted. Okay, and then they will walk in his ways. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?